I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to the History of Alchemy podcast. I'm Travis Dow.
And I'm Pete Coleman from the Bohemican podcast. Tonight we're going to be taking a look at a very interesting man at a very interesting time by the name of Michael Sedzivoy in Polish, and also in his Latin term, better known as Michael Sendivogius. Michael Sendivogius was born in 1566 and died in 1636. He was known as an alchemist, a philosopher, and a medical doctor. He came from a very noble family that was part of a clan called Ostoja. This interesting clan had a very unique characteristic about them. The Ostoja clan was very focused on choosing their members rather than putting an emphasis on the true bloodlines. Michael Sedivogius studied in Vienna, Altdorf, Leipzig, as well as Cambridge. So he did a lot of traveling for his studies. His acquaintances are kind of a who's who, including John Dee and Edward Kelly. In the 1590s, he was active in Prague at the very famously open-minded court of none other than Rudolf II.
Our favorite here at History of Alchemy podcast, right? Bohemian podcast as well. Yeah, we've done an episode on Rudolf II, so you guys should definitely check that out. But he was also in, because we mentioned he's Polish, so he was also appeared at the court of the Polish king Sigismund III around 1600, and he was very famous at his time, so he was the Polish king as well as Rudolf II, the Holy Roman Emperor, were themselves kind of alchemists or alchemy enthusiasts.
So they're very enamored with Sedivogius at the time. I think that that was one of his issues, that if you can actually placate to the kings and the emperors, you're going to have a pretty healthy life.
He kind of played the system. I mean, we'll get into that, but he was definitely well known among royalty and nobility and such. One thing I like to look at with these alchemists was if they really did some science or not. And because he was an alchemist in the truest form. So he actually, he had very practical matters of turning something into gold. Okay. But he did actually develop ways of purifying and creating various acids, which is also important in alchemy, and purifying metals and other chemical compounds. He discovered that air is not a single substance and contains life-giving substance, which we would call oxygen. And 170 years later, similar discoveries were made by people like Scheele and Priestley. He incorrectly identified this food of life with the gas, which, you know, oxygen, given off by heating nitre, which is saltpeter. This substance, the central nitre is what he called it, had a central position in Sedzivoy's kind of scheme of the universe. So it played a central role. In 1604, Sendivogius's most important work based on the number of editions, which is 56 editions until 1787, has been published as De Lapide Philosophorum Tacticus Duodecim.
Okay, was that French or Latin?
I'm not sure.
It was Latin in a French accent, I think, is what you're trying
de
to say.
De Lapide, the treatise was printed in, yeah. The treatise was printed in, I'm sure it was Latin, but I just, you know, pardon my pronunciation. The treatise was printed in Prague, and its title was changed to Novum Lumen Chemicum in later editions. The 12th tract explains that the origin of heat would be motion. So, for instance, motion causes water to rise as steam, which is interesting.
Kinetic energy.
That's
right?
Basically true. Yeah,
absolutely. Eventually, the Habsburg Emperor Rudolf II granted him land in Bohemia and Moravia, where he later settled. He became lured to the court of Duke Friedrich Württemberg of Stuttgart in 1605, who had noticed Sendivogius' claim in De Lapide Philosophorum to possess the secret of the Philosopher's Stone. So here's a concept that he is so well known at this point as an alchemist that was successful at making this happen. Making gold.
Yeah.
All right. So,
like, supposedly he had done it. I mean, he had the secret.
So. And at this point, could you be even more of a rock star? No, you can't. All right. So this guy is known.
The guy that can make money?
The guy that can make money. So the Duke put Cynovogius in prison. Why not? You're going to keep the guy that made gold in prison under your watchful eye. But here's the problem. Sigismund III from Poland, Rudolf II, the Holy Roman Emperor, and several other German princes intervened, and Friedrich grew very alarmed.
Yeah.
All right. So if you can think about this going, okay, I think I've overstepped my bounds here, and I know I'm the big deal in Stuttgart, but when the Holy Roman Emperor says, you got to let him go, what are you going to do? Well, this is what he thought. He arranged for Cynovogius to escape and put the blame on his very own court alchemist, Heinrich Mühlenfels. Mühlenfels was then condemned to die. So can you see the drama here playing out? So Cynovogius gets let free. The blame goes
to
somebody else.
You know, they arranged an escape, right? So it's like a sneaky way to...
So he's
can't just let him go.
Can't let him go. Yes. He's got to somehow make it happen himself. Yeah. So he put the blame on his... Friedrich put the blame on his own alchemist and basically covered his own tail with other powers that be in Europe breathing down his neck. So he got a situation where Cynovogius is now on the run, on the lam, trying to probably make his way back to friendlier territory.
Yeah,
as the alchemist who has knowledge of the Philosopher's Stone.
Yeah, very kind of interesting story. I mean, there's other parts to his life that, because he wasn't just an alchemist per se, but being in these different courts, some say that he was perhaps there as a spy in one court or the other, so that he might have been sent by the emperor to, you know, say to Sigismund, to his homeland, to Sigismund III. And at other points in his life, he was married to Ferdinand II. To two of his sisters at different points. He wasn't a polygamist, but so he also had some kind of diplomatic tasks or errands, let's say, such as he negotiated Poland's access to the Black Sea. You know, he negotiated this with the Habsburgs, right?
Which is, by the way, no small task at the time. Many countries, including the time of the Russian power, considered the Black Sea theirs. And that was, you know, for a lot of people, other than the other parts of seagoing areas, the Black Sea was supposed to be someplace where you can get a lot of wealth and trade going on. So kudos to him.
Yeah.
Good diplomatic maneuver.
But he had the ear of the king, had the ear of the emperor, so it's, you know, why not? Why not try to make some diplomatic arrangements here? Eventually, he lived in, you know, kind of the beginning of the 30 Years' War. And then, obviously, the priorities shifted from trying to create gold to trying to win battles. And he was one of the biggest landowners in Bohemia. That's how much Rudolf II loved him. You know, think about Rudolf II, right? This is the alchemist emperor. But by the time he died, he kind of fell in obscurity and was even poor at some points. He was the court alchemist to Rudolf's successor, but, you know, as soon as the 30-Year War hit, that was it for him. Not to mention he was a Catholic and, you know, had to kind of watch which side of the law he's on or which side of the war he's on. But his great work and legacy is called A New Light of Alchemy, and originally published in 1605. And this is, it's interesting. I've read parts of this book in a book called The Alchemist Reader. It's written in an alchemical language. So even if you can read it, it's still basically only understandable by other alchemists. And I'll kind of go into that a little bit. But it's funny because in the book, he's like, so here's the importance of the Philosopher's Stone. And here's how you make it in vague terms. And here's, okay, now let me tell you exactly how to do it. And he writes it down. And it is not clear at all. Because when I talk about alchemical language, like if they say mercury, we know what mercury is. But to an alchemist, that's not the case. In fact, there's an interesting story that I'll mention in a little bit here. But mercury is not just quicksilver. It could mean pure mercury. It could be the way to make philosopher's stone, but it might have nothing to do with what we would call mercury, like the element. Same thing with gold. Gold is not always gold.
So do we have a type of Rosetta Stone here to decipher this
type of
language?
You can get into these, yes and no, because you'd have to understand a lot of the assumptions that alchemists work with. So a lot of just their basis of reality is very, very different. So, like, for instance, and this gets very strange very quickly, but he would talk about gold even pure gold not being pure gold. So they do not understand an element the way we would understand an element. So they would say that all metal is one substance, okay? So copper is, or let's say tin is unripe copper, and copper is unripe silver, and silver is unripe gold. And it's, you know, it's basically in the womb of earth. And as soon as it comes in contact with air, it stops ripening. So, and gold is unripe gold to the point where the philosopher's stone is pure gold to the point that it is so pure that it can make, it's like a fruit that has seed. So you can make more gold with it. So, and that is, I am simplifying it so much right now. Like, I'm trying to make this understandable on some level. But so he's saying, like, okay, so if you get gold, that is probably the purest metal. But if you want the philosopher's stone, you want gold that can make gold, you need to ripen it even more. How do you do that? Well, good thing you're asking an alchemist, because in an alchemist lab, that's where you would do this. So basically, you want to ripen the gold in natural ways. Like, he would heat it for 10 months, you know, mix it with mercury, give it, you know, the right conditions that you would find in the earth. And the earth, by the way, is a windy and porous place. So not like earth that we know of. I mean, this is
I don't see a lot of science.
Right, so this is more like, a science fiction kind of, you know, like center of the earth kind of philosophy.
But you know, I can be a fly on the wall here and listening to him maybe tell this to Rudolf II. All right, Your Highness, Holy Roman Emperor, gold is everywhere. It's just in different forms, at different eras of pressure and time and connection to the elements that make it gold what it is. But I can tell you what, I can make it for you. So if you can give me some nice land in Bohemia and make sure I get fed every night and protect me from all my enemies, I'll keep working for you.
I'll keep working on it. Here's the thing. here's the thing that made alchemy such a great thing for all these people to practice is because you want me to make you gold? You want me to make you the philosopher's stone? I need gold to do it.
Uh-huh.
Okay?
Okay.
Then, well, how's it coming? Well, hold on. I need to heat it for 10 months. So ask me again in 10 months. Okay? So right there, just from those two things I've said, and it gets way more complex than that. So, oh, yeah, I got gold, but do you happen to have some mercury on you? And no, not that mercury. So,
but we also know through history that there's a limit. And even Rudolf II from our previous episodes had a limit where he said, okay, it's been several years, dudes. Where's the gold? Well, you see, here's the problem. You know, and that didn't fly. So, I think there probably was a limit. But while the getting was good, looked like he got along okay.
Now, this is actually, it's important to note because Rudolf II did kill a lot of the alchemists, but this is the one that got away. This is the one that actually, because according to one story, he actually had a tiny bit of philosopher's stone powder from someone named Seton. Alexander Seton, I could not find anything else on this alchemist, but the only time I could find something on this alchemist is from this story. So this is the alchemist that was imprisoned by someone, and he had some philosopher's stone powder, and it was actually like the church or someone that arrested the Seton for occult practices, and Sendivogius freed him, and in thanks, right before he died, he gave him some of this powder. So Sendivogius was the man that had created gold. He was the man with the philosopher's stone. So he was like proof that alchemy is real at the time. Of course, he still died a poor man in obscurity. So, you know, what does that tell you? But it, you know, this was in his lifetime. He was just incredibly famous and rich from royal, you know, salaries and whatnot. Now, he was influenced by Ramon Llull, who's important because we'll do an episode on him. He's a really interesting character. And Bernardos Trevisanos. So, yeah, it gets funny. I'm reading an interesting story right now. So there's this alchemist, and he goes a bit loony. So if you're dealing with evaporated mercury, that's wont to happen. The thing is, so he's in the story that Sendivogius wrote, it's an alchemist, and he's talking to his equipment. Because like I mentioned, mercury is not just mercury, right? So here's the alchemist, and he's talking to his mercury. And then the book is like a dialogue of, you know, his mercury and the alchemist, and he's like, so are you mercury or is there another? And he's like, well, I surely am Mercury. And he's like, yeah, but is there another Mercury? Like, are you the purest form? And he's like, I am Mercury, but there is another Mercury, you know. So I mean, clearly the alchemist kind of goes loony, so gold is not always gold, mercury is not always mercury, you know. Even if you're talking about, like, if we say the four elements, like earth, air, fire, water, those mean very different things to alchemists. But we'll go into that in a different episode as well. Even after he died, he had a huge influence in alchemy as a field.
His name didn't disappear in history, of course, as we're talking about it today. But it was something that was influential for many people, including Sir Isaac Newton, who had read his work and known pretty much a little bit of this chemical language that he was talking about. Mm-hmm. So it's something that kind of went through the centuries along with him after his kind of quiet sort of pauper's death. He still lived on from his work.
Even today, if there's a fictional, especially in Polish literature, he's often mentioned in fiction. So it's he's still around.
And very well known in Poland.
Yeah.
Specifically in Krakow, near the Wawel Castle, which is right on the bend. If you're actually going through Krakow, an absolutely beautiful city, pretty much the antithesis of Warsaw. I don't want to upset people from Warsaw. Warsaw is one of those really developing cities in Europe and doing a great job. However, if you want a really classical viewpoint of a Polish city, it would be Krakow. And it's right along the Wisla River. At the biggest bend in the turn of the river, you will see the Wawel Castle and the Wawel Cathedral. And in the Wawel Castle, it still exists today, is a chamber where his experiments were performed, and it's still kept pretty much intact. So kind of a neat thing to do if you're ever in southern Poland to go see this. It's an amazing area. So really, to kind of sum up the life that we talk about today, he had very important influences both in the court among the Poles and among the Habsburgs. He even had some German princes on his side. He moved in very interesting circles, much like Edward Kelly and infamous scientists of his day.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that he probably lived an interesting life within these circles. So, you know, he had a very practical way of making gold, if you can consider it practical and if you can consider it understandable.
If you can read it, yeah.
If you could buy what he was selling, actually. But I think that his influence was pretty important upon the alchemist family of learned scholars, and, of course, was very influential even after his time.
And in today's episode, a lot of the information I got from the Alchemist Reader from Stanton J. Linden, which had excerpts of New Light of Alchemy and this other story I was reading where he's talking, you know, the guy goes loony and talks to his equipment. And again, like, it's in plain English, you know, but every word has a double meaning. Like, mercury is not just mercury and gold isn't just gold. So it's like reading a recipe. It's only like 2 pages long. But it's not what it seems.
Well,
so
evidently, we haven't really quite figured it out. Are
yeah,
you wearing a gold jacket right now?
I mean,
I'm not.
When I tried, I basically burnt my kitchen down, and my wife won't talk to me anymore. And I kind of singed my dog a little. So
I don't say, you know what, Travis, don't give up. I have faith that you're going to figure this out.
Yeah.
How about that?
Mm-hmm.
And when you do, we can take the podcast to a whole new level. Right?
When we do that, I'm
we
going
can
to
have an
retire.
Assistant that might help us edit.
Oh, not
we can hire somebody.
An editor.
That's great gold
yeah.
that we have.
First thing is I'm hiring a researcher. I'm done reading books. Well, anyways, if you want to read more about Sendivogius and other alchemists and occult philosophies, please stop by historyofalchemy.com. If you have any questions, corrections, ideas for other episodes you'd like to hear about, email us at podcast@historyofalchemy.com and find us on Facebook. Let's get a discussion going on some of these recipes here under History of Alchemy Podcast. We'd love to hear from you.
As well as their sister podcast, Bohemican.com. And at Bohemican.com, we've got pretty much everything you want to know about Czech Republic, at least from the standpoint from an American expat sort of viewpoint. Living here abroad is an amazing journey. So please take a look at Bohemican.com. We'd love to have you there. So we'll be back every 2 weeks. Thanks for listening.
Yep. Thanks very much.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.